Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest is Professor Rogers M. Smith, who is the Christopher H. Brown Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of numerous books, including Still a House Divided, Race and Politics in Obama's America, and Civic Ideals, Conflicting Visions of Citizenship in U.S. History. Professor Smith is the Jefferson Lecturer on the Berkeley campus this spring. Professor Smith, welcome to Berkeley.
Delighted to be with you.
And looking back, how did your parents shape your thinking about the world? Was there a lot of discussion about politics and current events around the dinner table?
Yes. For reasons I don't fully understand, until I came along, nobody had pursued a career that had that much to do with politics directly. I come from a family of businessmen, teachers, and ministers, but my brothers, my parents, and I always talked about politics as long as I can remember, and also living in a state capital, I got involved in politics at a very early age.
What sorts of politics? Just state politics or civil rights? Or
Both, really. When I was 13, my brother and I got friends together and went down to the local teenage Republican club and got ourselves elected. He was president and I was vice president. He lost interest, but I continued with the teenage Republicans, eventually becoming state chairman of the Illinois Teenage Republican Federation. At the same time, I considered myself from Springfield an Abraham Lincoln Republican who was sympathetic to civil rights. And I did participate in some of the civil rights activities of the 1960s in Illinois. And these two things eventually proved in tension with each other because the story of the Republican Party in the 1960s is that it turned away from its heritage of being a party of strong national governmental action on behalf of civil rights to embrace of more state rights views and a lot of opposition to civil rights initiatives. And as that went on, the more I worked in Republican Party politics in the late 60s, the more I realized that my politics didn't fit with the way the party was going, and I moved in different political directions.
Where did you do your undergraduate work?
I went to James Madison College at Michigan State University, and that was a choice reflected by these experiences. I like to say that I was chairman for Teens for Nixon in the state of Illinois in 1968, and in the next few years, I came to question whether I had an adequate understanding of politics. And James Madison College was a program set up in the middle 1960s that was a small residential college within a state university with faculty hired primarily as teachers and primarily concerned with political philosophy and history. And I felt I needed to find an atmosphere where I had a lot of freedom to think about big questions of basic political principle and purpose because I was questioning everything I'd grown up believing in and had worked actively on in my teen years. And I saw in that environment a place where I could do that, and it was very formative for me. I realized that, for better or worse, I had a greater passion for studying, thinking, and writing about politics than doing politics, and so I became a professor as a result of having gone there.
Yeah, so it sounds like that you were living a life between theory and practice, or at least you were practicing it, and that really pushed you to see the importance of thinking about it.
Yes, practice drove me to theory, absolutely.
Yeah, right. And where did you do your graduate work?
Harvard University.
And who were your mentors there, and then what did you do your dissertation on?
My mentor was Judith Sklar, my thesis supervisor, who was a political theorist originally from Latvia, who had fled both Stalinist and Hitler's tyranny in Europe, and went on to be educated first in Canada and then at Harvard herself, and who, even though she was a great expert on the grand European thinkers, her interests were turning increasingly toward American political thought because she felt that it represented a body of reflection on trying to operate institutions of self-governance that was the most extensive that we had in the world. And my interests were to try to explore what were the sources of what I saw as wrong in American politics and what might be better directions. And so she was a great person for me to work with, and she was a just marvelous teacher and thesis supervisor and became a great friend. I wrote my dissertation on, it was called Liberalism and American Constitutional Law, also my first book, because I was concerned that a lot of the discussion of constitutional issues didn't grasp the contestation and transformations in American political thought, broader American political principles over time. And I wanted to show how constitutional development had been shaped by problems in the prevailing principles of public philosophy with which the nation had began, and how constitutional doctrines often reflected very different visions that had come to the fore subsequently. And as I worked on it, I also felt, well, now I know out of these different traditions that have shaped America which way I want to go. And so the last part of the dissertation and book argue more normatively for a certain understanding of American constitutionalism and the directions in which it should go. I don't agree with everything I wrote then, but it did help resolve some of these really painful uncertainties that I'd formed through my teen years and gave me a sense of what I was for.
And you gravitated towards subjects of constitutional law, citizenship, and political identity, and then continuing the interest in the problem of race in American politics.
Yes, that was in many ways unanticipated. I see myself now as a person whose scholarship has primarily been devoted to the question of how politics crafts political identities and statuses of different kinds, including racial and citizenship statuses. But that wasn't the way I thought of my work when I was in graduate school and in the first part of my career. Instead, I turned to the study of citizenship after I completed my first book because there was a debate raging then amongst historians and political theorists about whether America had originally been more devoted to what were seen as liberal conceptions of citizenship. The state exists primarily to protect individual private pursuits, economic pursuits, religious pursuits, etc., or whether Americans had a more Republican conception of active civic service to the common good. And I thought if you looked at the history of citizenship laws carefully, you might be able to get a picture of how these different ideals manifested themselves and which were more predominant in different periods. But when I began looking at American citizenship laws, I found things that my education had not prepared me for, although my life experiences, both in Illinois and South Carolina, had prepared me for it. And that was that American citizenship laws historically were explicitly structured as systems of racial and gender hierarchy through most of U.S. history. At that time, for about 80% of U.S. history, most of the world's population, regardless of how liberal or Republican their political beliefs were, they were ineligible for U.S. citizenship because of their race, and ineligible for full citizenship because of gender, And that elaboration of racial, gender, to some degree religious conceptions of American civic identity, I felt was not adequately captured in the scholarship and teaching I'd been exposed to. And so it became my concern to offer a different understanding of American political culture and American political development that showed that these were central contributing features of American life, to analyze why and to analyze where we might go. And that did turn me into a scholar of race in America, as well as a scholar of the construction of political identities more broadly.
But before we talk some more about this intellectual journey and look at a couple of your books, let's talk a little about doing political science and relating that to how journey has developed. What are the quality of character and the skills that have to be developed to do political theory?
I think that you need a sort of driving concern with big political questions. In terms of character, you have to have the confidence to do justice to your own perspective. That is to say, you're not going to be able to contribute to these issues unless you're honest with yourself about what you think is important that isn't being captured in existing perspectives. If you simply try to follow what other people are saying, you're not going to have anything distinctive to contribute to it. But I also think that scholarship in political theory, scholarship in general, the highest responsibility is intellectual honesty, and it can be particularly challenging in political theory because if you care about big questions and you care about the distinctive things you have to say about them, there is great pressure to do scholarship that serves your normative agenda. You have to earn that. You have to earn that by being tremendously conscientious about paying attention to all the arguments and evidence that speak against what you think you want to say. I think some of my readers wish I were less attentive to mountains of evidence in some of my work than I am, particularly in my very long book, Civic Ideals. But I feel that's part of the responsibility of the scholar.
It would seem that history is important for someone doing the kind of work you're doing. Because talk a little about that, because one of the traps of political science is to become so theoretical and so self-consciously imitative of science that they lose sight of real events and both in the past and the present.
Yes. One thing that my thesis supervisor, Judith Shklar, surprised me about early in my time working with her is that she said, you have a good sense of history. And she didn't issue a lot of compliments. And also, I didn't think I had a particularly good sense of history. And I came to realize that what she meant is that I have always thought and continue to feel that it is at best a question whether we should understand political science as seeking relatively timeless patterns of regular behavior in the way that some understandings of the natural sciences understand their goal to be. It is a question whether human political behavior is captured by the same fundamental regularities in all times and places, at least regularities that are not at such a high level of abstraction that they don't illuminate very much. The only way you can consider whether that's true or not true is to do a more historical political science that looks at politics over time and asks the questions, are we really finding similar patterns? Are there fundamental transformations that make politics in one period very different than another?
In a paper that you did for the Social Science Research Council, you talked about what you saw as the tensions within the disciplines. And one of those tensions was, on the one hand, political science seeing its mission in its history as being one of educating people for democracy and public affairs. But then on the other hand, a search for scientific truth. Talk a little about that tension and how it can be transcended in a way to do both.
There are really a couple of tensions. In terms of the intellectual mission of political science from its origins in the Progressive Era, its leaders always said, we're simply trying to find the truth about, the scientific truth about politics, let the chips fall where they may, and also we're serving American democracy. Well, it's possible that the scientific truth about politics might discredit American democracy in some ways. So there is a potential tension there. One way that the discipline resolved it is to say that, well, we're not only seeking scientific truth about politics, we are, through our teaching, disseminating greater political understanding, that greater understanding is bound to help American democracy, even if some of our particular findings are disturbing for faith in American democracy. It is a reality of especially the last quarter century that the evolution of the modern American research university has meant that scholars are becoming more and more segregated into those who do lots of research and very little teaching, and those who do lots and lots of teaching and have very little opportunity for research. And I think that this is a damaging trend. I think that the public support for our work comes more for our teaching than our research, and that we do both our research and teaching better if we are doing both, and that done properly, teaching about politics helps resolve the tension between seeking scientific truth and serving American democracy, because it is one of the good things about the American public, in my view, that they want teaching that helps develop understanding of a certain amount of political knowledge and also critical skills, critical reflective skills, particularly at this moment in American politics. Most people don't think everything is great, and they want their kids to develop skills in critical thinking that can help come up with new answers, help them adapt with changes over time. So I don't think that there needs to be such a tension between the research and teaching mission or between finding truth and making a public contribution. But right now, I think we are experiencing difficulties in political science because these tensions are pulling us in different directions instead of working together productively.
When you were talking earlier about your intellectual journey, you brought us to the point at which you dealt with this problem, which you cover in your book Civic Ideals, and let's use that as a case study in the way a political scientist slash theorist works. Interestingly enough, that the theory there, which we'll talk about in a minute, which you touched on, really derives from really looking at the history of American laws on citizenship, where you were working on one problem and then you discovered something else. So it's really it can give us insight into sort of creativity, basically. Tell us about that journey.
Fundamentally, I was looking for whether American leaders thought of citizenship more as a matter of individual rights or private pursuits or active public service, as I said, and I came across speeches like Stephen Douglas saying, I believe this nation was made by the white man for the white man and that it should always be governed by the white man and not by blacks or Indians or Asians or any other inferior race. This is what he said openly because it was the politically popular thing to say. And at that point, I faced a choice of either not paying attention to the prevalence of this sort of discourse in American elections, in American legislatures, and by American courts through at least the first two-thirds of our history, and instead focusing on the kind of themes that the scholarship was already featuring, or else I had to engage in some rethinking about, well, why did we have this discourse in a country that did have commitments to democracy and human rights? Why was it so politically powerful? What were the forces contesting it as well as contributing to it? And so then I had a whole new scholarly agenda.
And what you were discovering, I guess, seemed to, if not contradict, then help us understand theoretical ideas about America that were on the table, for example, Louis Hart's. So you were, with this data, coming to a realization that, well, there are things not being addressed by the prevalent notions of what we are about as a people.
Right. Louis Hart's, who also grew up in a different part of the Midwest, but was from an immigrant family. He was in the 1950s, especially in the days of McCarthy, preoccupied by the question of why Americans seem so hostile to socialist alternatives. And a lot of scholars, understandably, in the Cold War years, the question of socialism, capitalism was central to them, and therefore they tended to see it as central to American political culture. And they interpreted American political development fundamentally around the question of why no socialism. Those perspectives kept issues of civil rights at the margins, at most presented in terms of, well, were there leftovers of pre-capitalist systems that meant that some people resisted embracing equal rights, or is it fundamentally, as communists said, in the mid-20th century, American capitalism that is responsible for racial inequalities? They had trouble making both those arguments work, and so mostly they kept these issues to the margins. And that's why the discipline of political science had little to say about the rise of the modern civil rights movement. Now, that began to change in the late 60s and 1970s. You couldn't ignore the importance of civil rights struggles in American politics anymore, and the scholarship began to change. But when I was first writing on these themes in the 1980s, there was still a dominant scholarly concern to see how can we encompass these struggles over race without changing our dominant pictures and models too much. And I was pushing for more substantial change. There was a lot of resistance. Most of my early articles were rejected by journals in the discipline, and I didn't have tenure, so that was very disturbing. But I persisted.
So that really what in this evidence that this gold mine of evidence that opened up for you. You really found again and again the exceptions to what we perceived as the general rule about who we were.
Exactly. The more I looked, I found that in area after area of the law, in area after area of political discourse, there was plenty of talk about individual rights. There was plenty of talk about Republican self-governance, but there was also plenty of talk about race, gender, about America as a Christian nation, etc. And so that what was presented in the models on which I'd been educated as marginal instead appeared to be have a much more central place in the overall frame, not the only things going on, but equally as important as many of the other things that had been stressed. And so then the challenge became to see how all those things fit together. I want to note, though, that even though the fact that people weren't buying my argument meant that I just kept piling up more and more evidence and finding more and more evidence, and so I thought I could say this isn't the exception. This is a central dimension of American experience. This is these are robust American traditions. I found lots of evidence, and that was ultimately important. It was actually only when I went back through the text of Louis Hart's, the text of Tocqueville that he built on, Gunnar Myrdal and other influential writers, and said, look, here are particulars of their accounts that just aren't persuasive because they haven't paid enough attention or they have made unpersuasive arguments about race and gender, et cetera. It's only when I not only provided the evidence but also directly criticized the iconic models that political scientists began to pay attention.
So what you were seeing was that the kind of when the tire hits the road, when the ideals have to be addressed in real political time with realities on the ground, that it's still about building coalitions, and that leaders often adjust to vested interests in areas like citizenship that lead them to draw lines that demonstrate that our perfect ideals are not realized in fact for some people.
Yes, actually my position is more radical than that.
Okay.
You're right. It's about building coalitions, but it's not that the leaders have high ideals, but to build coalitions, they have to make concessions with some people whose ideals they don't like. It is rather that we have had more ideals contending to govern America than we like to acknowledge. Stephen Douglas in running against Abraham Lincoln, Andrew Jackson in getting rid of the Indians, Woodrow Wilson in segregating the federal civil service, they were not making concessions to those who had nasty beliefs that they didn't accept. They believed America was supposed to be a white man's nation. That was part of their civic ideals. And it is true that because so many Americans have been invested in these ideals of America, that in building coalitions, you have to take them into account. And even politicians who don't embrace them fully, like Lincoln himself, his speeches make concessions to the white supremacist notions of his day. Nonetheless, the reason that those concessions are necessary are in part because lots of American leaders, as well as other Americans, actually believe in these racial, gender, religious, hierarchical notions of American identity.
Well,
historically.
Historically, but this sounds very relevant for our times, and we'll get to that in a moment. In your other work, you have a book on where you're looking at nation building on peoplehood, I think you call it. What the exact title of the book?
Stories of Peoplehood, peoplehood. Encompasses nations and other forms of political community.
And what you're arguing there, as I understand it, is that leaders talk to people with narratives that help to build a sense of political community, and the leaders both help shape that community, but they have to find that community. The community has to be there. Is that a fair rendering? Help me understand.
That's close. I think finding goes too far to imply that the community is somehow already really there. In an effort to understand construction of American civic identity and civic ideals, I had to think more generally about, well, what are the processes through which senses of common political identity come to be? And I endorsed the view now that's widespread, I think rightly, in modern social sciences and humanities, that there is no political community that is simply there, that is simply natural, and there is no political community that is uncontested in the sense that those who are members of what are recognized as existing political communities also are products of historical experiences that mean that they have a sense of multiple potential identities and allegiances, and there are always people willing to try and mobilize them in a different direction than the community commitments they already have. So the argument of that book is that more than political scientists have recognized, it is a central continuing task of political leaders always to tell stories that help inspire people to think they should embrace the sense of political community and the leadership that those leaders are putting forward. Now, they can't succeed if they don't tell stories that resonate with people. So they do have to build on the pre-existing senses of identity, the pre-existing economic interests, the pre-existing ideologies or faiths that people have. They have to build those, draw on those elements, and put them into a story that can persuade people to embrace that political community, in effect, to be part of a coalition to sustain it. And, of course, they want that coalition to be one that not only embraces the political community, but embraces those leaders as the people who should be in charge of it.
It would seem useful at this point to maybe compare some of our leaders. And let's talk a little about Lincoln at first, because he clearly, in over time, the time of his career in dealing with slavery, really came up with a new definition of the community.
Yes. Lincoln redefined the American story as one in which the American people had created themselves as a people dedicated to realizing the principles of the Declaration of Independence. It's not that that was never suggested before, but Lincoln is the one who made that central to the American understanding. The Declaration of Independence, in the eyes of the courts, does not really have any specific legal force. It's the Constitution that's authoritative. But Lincoln said we should interpret the Constitution as a set of structures designed to help us over time progressively realize the purposes of the Declaration of Independence. His own understanding of those purposes evolved. When he first articulated this view in 1854, he said, and the principles of the Declaration of Independence mean government by the consent of the governed. That was the sheet anchor of American republicanism. Well, that was a problematic position for him because it appeared to imply that African Americans who were governed should be enfranchised. And he wasn't prepared to push for that either politically or personally. It would have been disastrous. I don't think at that point in his life he was prepared to embrace it. So he reinterpreted his story to say, we are dedicated to realizing the principles of the Declaration of Independence, and those principles are that everybody should enjoy the basic rights of life, liberty and free labor, the right to the fruit of your own labor. That meant slavery was against the principles of the Declaration of Independence. It did not clearly require enfranchisement and equal citizenship, but he understood the Constitution and the American people as devoted to a historic quest over time to realize the principles of Declaration of Independence more fully for Americans and ultimately for all the world, he said. And I think that that story, he sort of perfected it in his own mind as he went along, and he eventually concluded it did mean you had to support black enfranchisement, amongst other things. The example and the very difficult but ultimately successful transformations that his administration wrought in America through the Civil War, that made this story that we are the people of the Declaration of Independence seeking to fulfill it a much more central story in American political experience and development than it was before.
Reagan. Let's look at Reagan, because Reagan, in retrospect, it's very clear that he took the American narrative to a new place, that in a way harkened back to sort of liberal notions of the individual freed from the constraints of the state, but able to participate in the market. Help me with that. In other words, what was that his contribution? What else was he saying?
You're absolutely right that was the kind of story he told. But there is a fascinating development that I think contributed to Reagan's political success. From the time he began speaking out politically, he was primarily anti-communism, pro-free enterprise at home. But that took him so far. When the various conservative groups began forming coalitions and holding meetings in the 1970s, he began regularly giving annual speeches to the conservative convention. And beginning in the early 1970s, he hit on a new way of putting his story that became more and more dominant in his rhetoric over time. And that is, he seized on the story of John Winthrop on the Arabella giving a sermon which said that the new Puritan colony would be as a city on a hill. And from then on, Reagan told the story of America's anti-communist free enterprise system as the story of a nation that had a kind of providential mission to be the light of liberty to the world. And this meant that by 1980, Reagan was able to add to the economic conservatives the emerging religious right movement in American politics as part of a common coalition that, along with military conservatives, proved broad enough to become predominant in American politics over the next generation. And it's America as a city on a hill, but a city on a hill devoted to free enterprise and personal liberty. That's the Reagan story.
So interestingly enough, in a funny kind of way, our leaders, part of their task is to be a storyteller.
Yes.
That picks up strands of stories that have already been told, but constantly reorganizing them or adding new elements to essentially then have the coalition to actually get elected and then run the government.
That's exactly right. The one further stage is that while you need to build a broad enough coalition to govern, to get power and govern, number one, even though you might want a really broad coalition, you can't include everybody because some of your core constituents don't want the agenda of other people to be part of your agenda. So you have to make some choices. That also means that when you do come to power, there's still going to be rival powers. You don't have total power. And so it shouldn't be understood that the story you use to build the coalition and to guide your policies simply gets implemented in pure form in your policies and institutional innovations. There are always compromises, and those compromises become the overall structure of governance, of policies and institutions, and then those have consequences changing life in ways that shape what new coalitions are formed and what new stories are told.
So basically, you have to be an acrobat on a high wire, combining, you know, having in the one hand the narrative, but on the other hand, making real policies that may in part be inconsistent to the other part of your act.
Yeah, one of Ronald Reagan's political skills not adequately recognized, I think not even fully self-consciously acknowledged by himself, was that as an old actor who knew he didn't want to lose his audience, although he had a very strong story, a very strong political ideology, and tried hard to remain true to it, if you look at his actual governance, you'll see he made departures and accommodations to avoid alienating people too much over and over again. That's something that some of the those who look to him today have lost sight of. They treat him as more pure ideologue than he was in practice.
Obama.
Yes.
How does he fit into this story of the leaders who have narratives to win the vote?
Obama is probably more conscious of the tasks of political storytelling than most leaders, and he has he launched himself into national prominence with his 2004 speech, which was designed to merge his personal story with his version of the national story. And his story is that the America's special feature and special mission is e pluribus unum, out of many one, that we find ways to achieve common agreements and pursue common goals without effacing our diversity. He presented himself, I have one of the most diverse backgrounds imaginable, but I'm wholly committed to America, my very diverse family. We find ways to love and work together and help each other. All Americans can do that. In his speech in Cairo to the Muslim world early in his term, he did an interesting variation of Lincoln, who'd said in the Gettysburg Address that this nation was conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Obama said this nation was founded on the principle that all people are equal and dedicated to e pluribus unum, to achieving unity despite diversity. And Obama's story, which was inspiring during the campaign in a nation that felt deeply divided and polarized, was that he was the guy that could get people of very different views to come together, find common ground, help solve common problems, and move forward. And he always says, for those who refuse to do this, that's not who we are as Americans. He makes this the American story. We overcome differences, e pluribus unum.
Now, his problem today is a very different one. So let's look at the elements of the American gridlock, paralysis, fragmentation, whatever you want to call it, that exists today. And we have to identify two central problems. One is, as a result of the Reagan Revolution, the stark inequality that has emerged. I mean, that's clear to everybody except certain factions, obviously, the threat that poses. And then the second is America's relative decline in the world. So as somebody who studied narratives and also looked at the way our ideals aren't totally realized because some of the vested interests and the way they work their way through legislation and other means, Talk a little about that problem and those two problems and how what they pose for the American narrative and for political leadership, because President Obama seems to be having a lot of trouble.
Yes. Well, on the first point, it's just empirically undeniable that American economic inequalities have expanded to the greatest extent that we've known in our history since the late 19th century, and maybe through the 1920s. There was a diminishing of inequality from the New Deal through the Great Society on up to Reagan. There's been a great expansion ever since. We are profoundly divided about what to do about that. People at the upper end think there's nothing wrong with that. It's consistent with economic growth for all. A lot of people don't feel they're sharing in that economic growth. It has proven that Obama's efforts to achieve e pluribus unum by brokering compromises on economic policies, he just hasn't succeeded. And so there is a question now of whether we need a politics that, rather than simply seeking unity through compromise, does mobilize part of the population to get predominant power on the part of one set of policies and solutions in order to break gridlock. And part of Obama's challenge at this moment is whether he can mobilize broader support instead of just being the leader of reasonable compromise in the way that he has always tried to be. These issues do connect with America's relative decline in the world. It's still the world's largest economy. It's still by far the world's overwhelmingly powerful military nation. But it is true that the growth of American inequality has been achieved through the expansion of our financial sector and the relocation of most of our manufacturing overseas to other countries who are now outproducing us and whose economies are proving better founded for growth than this, I think, unduly finance-centered economy that we have developed. So that has contributed to our national decline. And this poses tremendous problems for Obama, who already has a tension in that his American story of e pluribus unum points to all of us embracing American identity. But what does that mean when you deal in international affairs in which everyone doesn't accept that what's good for America is the common good? Well, his answer has been to say, well, actually, e pluribus unum is my global philosophy, too, and I'm going to work multilaterally and consensually and achieve compromises that are good for other countries. But in a period of perceived American relative decline, then for a lot of the Americans where he said, I was going to bring you together and benefit America, he can be seen as selling out America to all these other countries, not standing up for it enough. It was helpful to him in this regard that he did succeed in commanding the operation that killed Osama bin Laden. And that showed, you know, America was still tough and effective in the world. That's not nearly enough to satisfy his critics who say, oh, he always goes around apologizing for America. He's too multilateralist. He's not standing up for us enough. And I think that American interests are served by multilateral policies in many respects. But the political challenge of having a story that persuades the American people that their interests are best served by those policies, that is a very daunting challenge, and I don't think anyone is meeting it right now.
And is part of the problem here that he's losing the coalition, or finding the coalition, or creating the coalition that would tie him to a narrative that would then resonate with the people? Does that sort of flow from your other arguments?
Yes, his coalition is both losing people And people that are still going to vote for him, now they're saying they're going to hold their noses and vote for him, and they may not turn out. You know, they're not going to vote for his opponent, but they're not going to turn out. It is fundamentally the failure to reach agreement on economic policies that could produce substantial job growth. Now, I think Obama can truthfully claim that he may have averted a depression. His predecessor saw job loss. He has seen some job growth, but it's very limited job growth, and with wages stagnant or declining for many Americans. And that failure to achieve economic success has made many independents give up on him, and it is demoralizing for many in his base. And so his coalition is vulnerable. Republicans face the task of building an opposing coalition, and that is daunting for them, too. But Obama has problems.
Your new book, Still a House Divided, Race and Politics in Obama's America, with Desmond, written with Desmond S. King, really is interesting at two levels. One, it's telling us why the problem of race endures, but it's tying that to where our political system is, and it's really a dark picture of a system that is polarized. Talk about that, because what it's suggesting more broadly is the state of that system means that you're not going to get the kind of compromises and working solutions to this problem we always confront of making our ideals real.
Yes. There are unhappy ironies in abundance here. Our argument is that American politics has always generated some central battleground racial issues, slavery, and then after it was ended, eventually the new issue emerged, Jim Crow segregation, and after it was ended, eventually new issues emerged in the modern era. The modern issues are whether racial policies should include race-targeted and race-conscious measures in which you decide policies on the basis of whether they will reduce racial inequalities or not, or whether it's better to have colorblind policies rather than inflaming senses of racial identity and difference. That's the modern debate. The first irony is that through much of American history, the two political parties were divided internally over slavery, over Jim Crow. And so they sought not to contest over those policies, but really to keep them off the agenda or to compromise them because they didn't want to be torn apart internally over what to do about slavery or Jim Crow. Their tendency not to address those issues meant that those inexcusable American institutions endured far longer than they should. The distinctive feature of the modern era is that today the racial policy coalitions for race-conscious or race or colorblind policies, they are almost fully identified with the two major parties. The Democratic platform since 1972 have always called for some forms of affirmative action. Republican platforms always denounce quotas and call for colorblind policies. So now the parties are more sharply opposed over racial policy issues. And that contributes to the more general polarization of American politics. It also contributes to a couple of things. Parties increasingly have not argued about racial policy issues much at all, even though they still have their official positions, because the Democrats know their positions are less popular with the predominantly white American electorate, and so they don't emphasize them. Because they're not emphasizing them, the Republicans don't have them to attack. So for different reasons than in the past, we have the parties avoiding actually talking about racial policy issues very much. Even Obama himself, in his celebrated National Constitution Center speech on race during the campaign after the Reverend Wright controversy, he talked about racial feelings, but not about racial policies. And it's also true that because we don't talk about racial policies, we don't seek to achieve what we think are a range of reasonable compromises between more race-conscious and colorblind measures. Again, the irony is it was wrong to seek compromise over slavery. It was wrong to seek compromise over Jim Crow segregation. We think it's right to seek compromise over how race-conscious or colorblind our policies should be. We should choose what policies will be most effective, both in reducing racial gaps and benefiting all Americans. And some of those will be fully colorblind. Some might be colorblind policies, but chosen for their good racial consequences. There's lots of room for compromise. We have our first black president who's devoted to compromise, but the system is incapable of achieving compromise because we don't talk about racial policy issues at all. And when we do, it's in tired repeats of these two sharply polarized positions that have come to structure modern debate.
So bringing your focus on political theory and understanding American ideals, but also grounded in a sense of coalitions and the actual working out of politics, is there a path that you see to get the U.S. out of its predicament?
If I had a path that I was really confident would get us out of our predicament, I would probably not be having this conversation, but would be in Washington trying to persuade people. I don't think I have all the answers. Again, my life experience has been that when I think I do have all the answers, I better rethink. I will say this, that it is important to understand that both the modern racial policy coalitions, the colorblind folks and the race-conscious, race-targeted folks, see themselves as the true heirs of the modern civil rights movement. They don't attack it. They celebrate it as part of the American story. The colorblind people quote Martin Luther King saying that we should judge people not on the color of their skin but the content of their character. The race-conscious people quote Martin Luther King in the same speech as saying America owes a promissory note to those it has mistreated, and so it has responsibilities to assist them. And the fact that we have now a nation that through much of our history had politicians that openly spoke of racial white supremacy as an American ideal, the fact that we now embrace with different interpretations, the civil rights movement, the end of segregation, the battle for racial equality as a central element of our American story across the spectrum. This is something we should be able to build on to say, look, we share commitments to finding ways to assist everyone while reducing racial equality. That is a central part of the American story as we've decided to develop it over time. I think that if we have political leaders who have the courage and also the wisdom to see the opportunity in emphasizing these elements of the American story, we have the potential to go forward. But it means they need to talk about racial policies, and right now, none of them think it's safe to do that.
Well, on that note, Professor Smith, I want to thank you for taking the time to be here today.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.